Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And it's time for an insect update. What's going on in the world of insects in our area of, in your area of the state? Our guest, PJ Leash, back with us, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We'll talk about, Japanese beetles. We can take a look at those elm zigzag sawflies and other things as well. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got an observation. Maybe you have a question about bugs in your area. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. PJ Leash, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Larry.
Let's start with Japanese beetles. How soon can we expect to see Japanese beetles?
Well, I think it's going to be a couple of weeks before we see our main push for these. They usually start emerging right around the 4th of July, give or take. And that can always shift a little bit. With insects, we can't really mark a firm calendar date. If you have an early warm spring, might shift things earlier or later, depending on conditions. In many years, though, I will hear my first reports right around now, kind of mid to later June. So I'm just waiting for those. I know they're probably starting to pop out maybe in some locations, especially if you had a south-facing hill that's just warming up in the sun a little bit more than other areas. So not here yet, but they will be popping out in a couple of weeks.
And they're fairly distinctive. I mean, you can tell one when you see one, I think, aren't
they? Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are. I mean, Japanese beetles, they're a type of scarab beetle, smaller than a May-June beetle or June bug, as a lot of folks call them. But they're close to half an inch long or so. They have a metallic sheen to the body, some coppery brown on the wings, otherwise a metallic green color. And along the side of their abdomen are these little tufts. It looks like hairs. As an entomologist, we call them seedy technically, but little tufts of hairs that are whitish. So very, very distinctive, although I will say there's another insect, the multicolored Asian lady beetle, that often folks seem to mix up those two names.
Mix those two up, yeah. So how are we in terms of spread across Wisconsin? Are they popping up everywhere in our state?
It's been interesting to watch, especially the last 3 to 5-ish years. So if we went back, say, 10, 15, 20 years, at that point in time, it was primarily an issue in southern Wisconsin.
Right.
I remember early 2000s or so, around 2010, west side of Madison, you could identify in August a linden tree from a mile away because it was completely brown because of feeding damage from it. The last few years, things have been relatively quiet in much of southern Wisconsin. I think part of that is due to some of the dry, droughtier conditions we've had. Could also be some other things, including some natural enemies. Maybe they are reaching kind of an equilibrium out in the ecosystem. The last couple years, though, most of my reports of high numbers of beetles and significant plant damage have been from the Highway 29 corridor, so like Eau Claire to Wausau to Green Bay. Also, I will say the Green Bay, Oshkosh, Sheboygan area, that triangular area, there's been some decent activity there as well. But otherwise, it's been more northern parts of the state. Wausau, Merrill, Minocqua, Rhinelander, Eagle River, even in northwestern Wisconsin up towards Spooner, we're seeing activity up there. Whereas 10, 20 years ago, we weren't really seeing them that part of the state. So definitely pushing their way northwards.
And understand that there is some biological control methods for Japanese beetles now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of options out there. And when it comes to management of Japanese beetles, in my mind, there's really a number of different scenarios that play out. And so I really ask folks, what plants are you trying to protect, be it your turf grass lawn or above ground trees or shrubs or edible crops, things like that.
There's grapevines.
Exactly. And you've got to pick and choose what'll work best for your given scenario. There are some efforts along the lines of biological control. Commercially, there are things like entomopathogenic or insect-killing nematodes. There's some bacterial-based products, although for some of those, the effectiveness is really pretty limited and pretty hit or miss in a lot of cases. One interesting thing that I have been watching, especially last year, is a particular fly called the winsome fly that we know will attack Japanese beetles, and it seems to be popping up a little bit more in Wisconsin.
So what do they do?
Well, the winsome fly, it's from a group, a family, the family Tachinidae. They're a little bit bigger than house flies. They have kind of a bristly appearance. And what tachinid flies tend to do is the female will lay white eggs behind the head of the insect that they're going to be attacking. And there's a bunch of different species in this group. Some attack caterpillars or other insects. Mm-hmm. But this winsome fly specifically attacks Japanese beetles. And it's really easy to identify them, even with your naked eye, because you'll see a Japanese beetle sitting on a grape leaf or another plant leaf. And then you'll look just behind the head, this big, broad kind of neck region we call pronotum. And if you see one or maybe two or three little white specks on there, those would be the eggs. And you can see that with the naked eye again. What that tells me is the winsome fly female found that adult Japanese beetle, and its days are numbered. Those eggs will hatch, the little larva or maggot will burrow inside, and that's going to be the end of the line for the Japanese beetle.
So do we have them? So we have some winsome flies in Wisconsin.
We do, and I have a colleague at the University of Minnesota who has been doing a project for a year or so looking for evidence of winsome fly in Minnesota and Wisconsin too, the upper Midwest. Many of the other reports are from kind of the eastern states where it's been established for a long time. But last year, I know colleagues at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection found them in a number of counties. I had some reports come into the diagnostic lab, and personally, my wife and I were grabbing coffee one morning in Minocqua, and we walked by the Minocqua Public Library and happened to see some on some Japanese beetles were on some plants right outside the library front door. And so that was the farthest north we've seen them in the state, which is good news, I think. Over time, that insect might potentially help kind of lower the equilibrium of Japanese beetles.
Do you think that's what's happened in, let's say, southern Wisconsin and Madison? I mean, we had this explosion and then they settled way down.
Yeah, it's possible that could be part of it, Larry. I mean, in my mind, it's probably a number of factors involved. Weather-related, natural enemies. Also, when we talk about non-native invasive species, one pattern that I tend to see is when an new pest gets to an area, I compare it to a wildfire. Very hot and damaging initially. After a while, things kind of mellow out and you're left with more of a slow smolder. And so there might be some population dynamics as well going on.
So speaking of potential explosions, last July, the elm zigzag sawflies were first detected in Wisconsin. Are you expecting them to return?
Yes. I have not personally had any reports yet this year, but they're probably out there doing their thing. This one was really interesting. It feeds specifically on elms. They'll go to American elms, Chinese, Siberian elms, and hybrids as well. And they get the name elm zigzag sawfly because the larvae will chew these very zigzaggy meandering tunnels on leaves.
Kind of cool looking tunnels. Actually.
Exactly. Very cool looking, very diagnostic. Eventually, the larvae get bigger. If you have a bunch of them ganging up on a leaf, they'll just consume the entire leaf. In some cases, and we don't fully understand why, but in some situations, they might cause a trivial amount of damage on the elm trees. In other cases, we've seen complete defoliation. And so that could really be hard on an elm tree, especially if you had like a large American elm. Maybe we've got concerns for Dutch elm disease and other issues. We have gone through the drought for a couple years. We luckily have some more moisture now. But if those elms are facing another threat, you know, that's one more thing that could put them on a slippery slope, so to speak.
Yeah. Should we be worried about getting rid of them off the trees?
Yeah, it really depends. As I said, in a lot of situations, they seem to cause a pretty small amount of damage. And so for the next couple of years, I think we're really going to have to wait and watch and see how it plays out on trees in your individual yard. There may be differences in tree species. Even within a tree species, you can have genetic variation. Some may have more defensive compounds or some other defense compared to others. And so I think we need to wait and watch. If you have a large landscape tree, there's not really any great options that you can do about it anyway. You know, if you had a really big tree, you're concerned about Dutch elm disease, you could chat with an arborist. But again, we don't know how much damage it's going to cause to your particular tree.
Yeah.
If you have, say, a small elm tree that's maybe under 10, 15 feet tall, or you recently planted one, there's going to be some options that you could do. Simple things, insecticidal soap, horticultural oils, and stuff like that. But I think we really need to wait and watch and see how much damage we will see play out in Wisconsin.
Lori emailed, this is a whole different subject, to say they have a problem with moths in her bedroom. For the past week or so, there have been 3 or 4 moths in the room, which Lori has killed. Sometimes there are as many as 8. Lori says she washed the bedroom curtains, vacuumed, and used pheromone traps, which did not catch anything. Is there anything else Lori can do to get rid of the moths? And unfortunately, she doesn't describe the moth. Okay. I wish she'd had.
Yeah, I mean, my first question in a case like this is, are we truly dealing with a moth? Because this time of the year, I see cases where a similar-looking insect called a caddisfly will sneak indoors if you have your windows open at night, and they can easily be mistaken for moths. And so I would want to rule that out. If they are moths, what type of moth are they? Are they clothing moths? Are they Indian meal moths? Are they something else? Knowing the moth species would really help crack the case, I feel, in this situation. So what I would recommend to Lori is if you are able to catch some of these. We don't want to crush them, but if you could catch some and snap some photos and send those to me, or you could put them in a little pill bottle or Tupperware and mail them into my lab, the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, then I can tell you exactly what they are. And once we identify the insect pest, in my mind, we're halfway done with the work, because now we can look up what to do about it.
PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him on to talk with us about bugs and insects. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at insects on the program today with P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you listening in today. Donald in Iron River has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Donald.
Hi, good morning. Say, I've got ash trees on my property, and half of them are all dead because of EAB, but I've got more that haven't been affected.
And so, and don't seem to be in any distress, Donald?
No, they're healthy.
Okay.
But the other ones are all dead.
Okay. And how is it that some have, your question, I guess, is how is it that some are surviving while the others are all dead, PJ?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it turns out in Wisconsin, we generally have 4 species of ash trees. Green and white are very common around towns because they've been deliberately planted as street trees, but they'll also occur in natural areas, especially along rivers. You get up north in swampy areas, there's black ash, and sometimes you can have areas that are 80-90% black ash, almost exclusively black ash. There's also blue ash, which very rare. I know there's been reported some native in some parts of southeastern Wisconsin, but otherwise that one occurs mostly elsewhere. I've in my entire life maybe seen 2-3 blue ash out there. Between all these ash species, though, there are some differences. We know blue ash, for example, does seem to have some tolerance or is not attacked and killed as readily. There's also some differences, and there's always the possibility that in a given spot, there's some genetic variation within a species that maybe gives them some ability to fight back against the insect. And so if you've seen that going on in your property, I would actually suggest maybe reaching out to the DNR. They may be interested to know that in general, we have folks going out and looking and gathering reports about surviving ash that maybe have some genetic tweak that allows them to withstand EAB, with the idea being on a long enough time scale, folks could identify those trees, maybe use them to reintroduce ash to different areas or create some hybrid that isn't killed by that insect. But again, there is some variation. If you go to places like Michigan that has had emerald ash borer longer than we have in Wisconsin, we know emerald ash borer has gone through, that wave went through, killed a lot of trees, and there's still some surviving ash.
So Donald, and so Donald should, the local DNR, he's in Iron River, so there's an office up there near
them. Yeah, I would probably start with that and just let them know that you are seeing live ash trees, because that may be of interest to folks with the DNR.
Yeah, and you could do that online or by phone. Donald, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Eagle River, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yeah, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, last fall, summer fall, I built a cabin in Amberg, Wisconsin, which is about 20 miles south of Iron Mountain on 141. And it's a brand new build, cement walls with a steel roof on top. We were inundated with beetles prior to the freeze. And they were just thick up there, thousands and thousands of them in the attic. And during the winter, many of them worked their way down, but we plugged the holes, you know, the attic scuttle hole and stuff like that. But we're kind of dreading this summer now because I think they're still up there. And we were wondering, should we bomb the attic? Some people have said don't bomb them because that's going to create food for other pests. Do we just let it happen and just keep them out of the living area? Because there's nothing in the attic. That it's just all it is space. What do we do with those? How do we solve that problem, or do we solve that problem?
And just a quick question. Can you get into the attic?
Oh, yeah. There's a scuttle, you know, just for maybe you had to get utilities or wiring or something. But for the most part, there's no usable space up there.
Yeah.
It's trusses and insulation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so when it comes to situations like this, there are things such as the multicolored Asian lady beetle. That's the ladybug that likes to sneak into homes and other structures in the fall. There's actually quite a few other things, box elder bugs, cluster flies, and whatnot. These are insects that we often refer to as fall invaders, because in late summer, early fall, these are insects that are looking for some sheltered spot to spend the winter. Now, out in nature, they might go to a cliff face, a bluff, a rock pile, under the bark of trees, but the way that we design our structures, perfectly suitable for them. So they're coming up to the structures and that can stand out visually to them. They're looking for cracks and crevices to get in. From the insect's point of view, they want to come in, hunker down for the winter, and then leave again in the spring. And if it's those multicolored Asian lady beetles, outdoors, they can actually be beneficial in some regards, feeding on aphids and pests like that. So with that said, I really wouldn't expect them to be hanging out still in your attic, because there's no food for them there. They feed on insects on plants like aphids. So I suspect live ones would have left. You could always pop up through that access hatch and take a peek, but I'm guessing live ones have probably left. Looking at the longer time scale and bigger picture, couple of things you could do. One would be referred to as physical exclusion. This basically means sealing up your cabin nice and snug so they can't get in the first place. So looking especially at like soffit areas, if there's gaps and cracks, could you seal it up with expanding insulation foam or caulk or some other means, checking weather stripping. Although it's a new house, you should have good weather stripping on doors and windows. But looking at the exterior of the house to seal it up better, if you can do that, in theory, they shouldn't be able to get in. So that'll help you out. The other consideration, if this seems to be an ongoing issue every single year, would be to treat the exterior of your house with a residual insecticide in late summer or early fall. basically before these insects are trying to get in. You're not spraying the entire structure. You're spraying a little strip around potential entry points. So edges of siding where the wall meets the soffit overhang and places like that around doors and windows to help repel or kill them before they get in. It doesn't take much. Again, we're not broadcast spraying everything, but a little bit of repellent insecticide. You can get these for yourself at the hardware store, like a home defense type product, or you can have a pest control professional do these treatments as well.
John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Perry in Elkano, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Larry and PJ. My question is, I have ants in the backyard, and that's where they only bother me. They leave those little ant hills, and of course, when you let your dog out in the morning, the wet dew and stuff, they run over those ant hills, and then you get mud into the or dirt in the house. So is there an easy way to eradicate the ones in the backyard? The front yard, we don't use it, so it's not a problem. And does diatomaceous earth, would that be effective to sprinkle on top?
Yeah. With ants, it depends a little bit on the species of ants involved. If you are seeing really big mounds, and these could be relatively flat, but they might be a foot across or more, or if they're actually big and mounded up, those would be a type of ant we refer to as field ants. And those can be more challenging because the nest itself can be rather deep. Sometimes it can go down 2-3 feet deep in the soil. Those are more challenging to control. If you have a situation like this, I mean, my first kind of comment about these is a lot of cases ants are beneficial. And so if they aren't sneaking into your house or causing other issues, simply tolerating them is one consideration. They can do a lot of good things out there in the environment. If it's a situation where you need to draw that line in the sand because they seem to really be tracking, you know, mud in through dog paws and things like that, probably the fastest, most direct route would be to get an ant control product you could mix up as a liquid drench and drench a bit onto each of the little mounds. That may take them out entirely or at least quiet things down for quite a while. Looking at just that part of the state, more, you know, northern parts of Wisconsin where we have sandier soil, a lot of cases ants are just going to be very common and ubiquitous because they've got soil that's easy for them to dig in. And so you're probably not going to be able to eliminate them entirely forever. But again, you could consider drenching individual mounds. The diatomaceous earth, I wouldn't expect to work very well just due to moisture outdoors.
Perry, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Maggie in Cottage Grove. Hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. How can we help you?
I, for the last 2 years, this year included, have noticed that my high bush cranberries, which I have growing wild on my property, are getting completely denuded by a very small larvae. And it's only the high bush cranberries. And I'm wondering if you know what these are.
Yeah, almost certainly this is an insect called the viburnum leaf beetle. And this is something that we first had established in the state back around 2014 over in Ozaukee, Milwaukee County area. So that's kind of the epicenter. But we did document our first case in Dane County back about 2019 or so. So I know General Madison area, Middleton, Fitchburg, Verona, Cottage Grove, these insects have a pretty strong presence. They feed on a wide range of viburnum, so that can include high bush cranberry. A lot of other plants from that plant genus as well. And what the larvae do in spring is they chew oblong holes in leaves, generally between the veins. We refer to that damage as skeletonization. And sometimes they can really cause a lot of damage, and those plants get clobbered. Sometimes with other types of viburnums, they may not be damaged quite as much. But that's almost certainly what it is. If you get out there early enough, the larvae you can control fairly easily with things like insecticidal soap, horticulture oil. Given the time of the year, though, what I would suggest is take a close look at the plants because the larvae might be gone. They go down to the soil to pupate, and if the larvae are no longer present, treating now won't really do you any good. However, once they pupate, the adults should be popping out in probably the next couple of weeks, and they can also feed and cause damage. But if you have highbush cranberry or other viburnum, and you have this insect in your ear, you're probably going to have to put up this fight every single year.
Okay, there you go, Maggie. Thank you for calling. Oscar and Stevens Point, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about some wood that I was splitting recently. I was chopping up some pine, probably hemlock, and about an inch under the bark, I saw these markings that I can best describe to be like a gear diagram that you'd see on the top of a shifting knob if there was like 7 or 8 gears.
Yeah.
Probably about an inch wide, and I couldn't really tell what it, I asked several arborist friends of mine, and forgive the pun, they were stumped. But yeah, I was calling to see if you knew if that was an insect or potentially what type of insect that would be.
Yeah, great question. In a case like this, I'd really wonder and encourage you, if you happen to have snapped a picture, by all means, feel free to reach out and email that to me, because sometimes there are some very subtle clues, very easily could be insects. When I think of pines and other conifers that have been cut down for wood, you know, these are usually the trees that died or were dying, and so we take those ones out. There's a very long list of insects that can be underneath the bark, digging around, tunneling, causing damage. And sometimes their tunnels will be very diagnostic. The width of the tunnels, the shape of the tunnels, presence of frass or sawdust-like material is either present or absent. And so just from the description, I can't give you a very definitive answer. I can say there's a very long list of beetles and other insects that could be possibilities. But if you have a photo and can email that to me, that will probably give me some clues to help narrow it down for you.
Yeah, and the if you go to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, you will see how you can do that, Oscar. Thank you so much for calling. And Megan in Black Creek will give you a chance. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yesterday, I was weeding, and I found this really pretty caterpillar that at first I was like, is that a swallowtail? And so I Googled it, and it said it was a caterpillar for toad flax. And they feast on yellow toad flax flowers, which are a weed, which I didn't realize when I planted them from my barn over into my garden. And so I'm just curious on, like, I don't know, like, is this a native thing? Is this something that was introduced? What do we do when we find something that's potentially beneficial?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to caterpillars, we probably have a couple thousand species here in the state. And so a case like this, just like the last caller, if you happen to snap any photos and can send those to me, I'd be able to narrow down exactly which species you bumped into. Off the top of my head, I can't think of many caterpillar cases that I've had on toad flax, so I'd have to dig into some of my caterpillar books to narrow down potential species. But again, if you have photos and can Google for the search for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab and send those photos to me, I should be able to narrow it down and give you an idea. I doubt it's anything invasive. I haven't heard of anything along those lines. Probably something native that feeds on plants from that general group, but some photos would really help us out.
All right. Megan, thank you for calling. Wayne in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Wayne.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you. I've been interested in insects since I could ever remember. I have a butterfly garden sporadically around the backyard. I have butterfly weed and then the broadleaf milkweed. I think I saw one monarch last year in my yard, but I never get any caterpillars. But I do know because there's aphids that get on the milkweed, the ants are crawling up and down the milkweed, and I'm wondering if the ants are eating some of the small monarch caterpillars. I like going to monarchwatch.com. That's a really great website, and I purchase tagging kits where you can tag the monarchs. And last fall, I went to 2 nature preserves where there was a lot of milkweed, but very few monarchs. And I'm wondering what's going on. Is it people using insecticides on their landscape, or is it overspray from farmers? And then I just wanted to mention, I had a, for the first year, I had a really bad infestation of the Japanese beetle. And so what I did is, and the tree is only maybe 25 feet tall, but I got a 6-foot ladder out and I worked my way down and bumping them off the leaves into a bucket of water and soap. And I would do that at least once a day, and it, that worked really well.
Yeah, that's one direct way to get rid of them. And Wayne, you were talking about monarchs. So just to mention, at 12 o'clock, at just after noon today, we'll be talking about the Environmental Education Center in La Crosse. We'll talk about pollinators. But one of the things that they do is also they deal with monarchs and monarch watch and tagging. So that's sure to come up in the conversation at noon. So stay tuned for that. But back to the main question that he had, Wayne, PJ.
Yeah, so the ants and aphids. So first of all, aphids can be very common on milkweed. There's a couple species that can pop up. There's also aphids common on just about any plant in your yard. And there's some interesting relationships between aphids and ants. So when aphids feed, they have these needle-like mouthparts. They poke it into the plant. They drink sap. They actually are, they're drinking so much sugar they can't digest it all. So their excretions are rich in sugars. It's basically sugar water. Certain ants love that. And so there's this relationship where ants will kind of act as shepherds almost and protect the aphids in exchange for the honeydew, the sugar, as a food for the ant colony. Now, when things like this go on, ants can be kind of territorial and defensive. And so it's possible that if you had a lot of aphids and ants on a plant and you have monarch caterpillars or something else, they may be acting kind of aggressively towards caterpillars or other insects. They just don't want them in the area. So that could be a possibility. If you have a big enough patch of milkweed, you're probably going to have some aphids, but in a lot of situations, there may be enough room for both aphids and monarchs. I have seen that plenty of times myself, but it might be something to do some closer observation on this year, just to see if you happen to find any monarch caterpillars, especially if you are seeing small ones one day, and then they don't seem to be there. Possibly the ants. There are also some other insects like paper wasps that are very aggressive hunters, and they will go out and pick off caterpillar after caterpillar. So that could be part of it. The Monarch Watch website you mentioned, that is a great website. Really cool to hear about you doing the tagging. I haven't done that myself. I have friends and colleagues that have done it. Sounds like a really fun experience. But the monarchs as a whole, it's a little bit sad to think about. If you were to look at and kind of plot out their population trends over the last 30 or so years, it's definitely downwards. Part of it may be spraying, but the analogy I will make is it's like death by a thousand paper cuts. It's not one single thing. It's land use changes, agricultural practices, pesticides, just general loss of milkweed compared to 50, 100 years ago, things like that. And so we have scientists that watch their populations. They assess the overall size of the population in winter when they're all crammed together, but it has been a downward trend overall for decades. There's variability from year to year. This last winter, they were up from the previous winter, which is good news. But still, if you were to compare their numbers to 30 years ago, they're way down. So that's some sad news at the moment.
Yeah, it is indeed. I did tag one monarch, and it was kind of a cool experience to do for sure. And the larvae, the caterpillars, there are all kinds of things that can attack those monarch caterpillars when they come out. I mean, it's a tough life they've got there.
It is. Well, and if you look at the literature on monarchs, and this is going to be true of monarchs, but many other insects, there's a high mortality rate.
Yeah.
And that's just part of their strategy of life. They have a lot of offspring. A lot of those are not going to make it. I forget the exact percentage estimate for, you know, monarch eggs that make it to the adult stage, and it's like single digits.
Yeah.
So a lot of things can feed in them. There's insect predators, there's diseases, you name it.
Wayne, thank you for calling. Let's take a call from Jeff and Merrill. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Great show as usual, guys.
Thank you.
When it comes to the Japanese beetle, a lot of gardeners can get into some really heated debates about the beetle traps, the Japanese beetle traps. They work fantastic. They kill the beetles when they go in there, but are we just attracting more beetles to our property and our gardens when we hang them? And it would sure be great to get a definitive answer. Do we hang the traps, or are we doing more harm than good? Just real curious.
I'd put them over on the neighbor's yard, quite a ways away from yours, myself. But what do you think, BJ?
Yeah, I'm going to side with Larry on this one. So it's an interesting question. And I have used, years ago when I had a research appointment, I would use the Japanese beetle traps because they were very effective at collecting lots of beetles in a short period of time. So I could put them out 2 hours later, have hundreds of beetles to do experiments. That made it really easy to do. However, there are a number of research studies by folks like Dr. Dan Potter, who is at University of Kentucky, and some of his lab mates that looked at these. In some of the studies, they'd put them out in like residential yards, different heights or different distances from plants. And they were finding that you would end up getting more plant damage when the traps were present. Yes, you're going to catch beetles, but in terms of preventing damage from plants, you generally saw more damage. So I do not recommend using the traps if your thought process is, I'm going to put these out, therefore I'll reduce plant damage. The data don't back that up. It seems to cause more damage. So as Larry alluded to, you know, one thing, and there's still research going on about these traps. One possibility is if you have like a massive yard and you can put that trap very far away from the garden, could you potentially pull them away? That's a possibility. But if you have a small yard, like my yard's a quarter acre yard, I would not use them in my yard.
All right. Jeff, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking your questions, and you can join in. Have open lines get you on pretty quickly now. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just to mention, coming up at noon, we'll talk about collaboration between the Nature Place and Environmental Education Center in La Crosse and the author of a new children's book about pollinators. And then at 12:30, we'll talk about efforts to protect our northern forests with two Midwest-based members of the Nature Conservancy joining us. Right now, it's Insects with PJ Leash. Lines are filled now. So before we go to the phones, though, I did want to call attention to a photo Stacy in Broadhead emailed to say they found small black insects on their coneflowers a couple of days ago. They've never seen them before and wondering if they're a new invasive insect. Stacy didn't find them on other perennials.
Yeah, so looking at the picture, Larry, this is an orangish caterpillar, and what really stands out to me is the abundance of these black spikes on the body. And when I see caterpillars that look like that, that tells me that it's actually a type of butterfly, the family Nymphalidae. Many of those caterpillars have this very, very spiky appearance that might be a defense so that, you know, if a bird went to try and eat them, the spikes would be a deterrent. I can't quite pin down the exact species off the top of my head from the photo. It's definitely from that butterfly group. I'd probably have to sit there and compare host plants and also some of the caterpillar, the appearance in some of my caterpillar guidebooks, but definitely a type of butterfly it looks like.
So what are the black sort of spots that we're seeing there next to the caterpillar?
So that would be frass. That's a fancy word basically for bug poop. It's their excrement with bits of plant material in there.
There you go. Let's go to Brent in Wausau. Brent, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about carpenter ants. I replaced a rotten eave board maybe 10 years ago and noticed the sawdust-like material that is associated with carpenter ants. And over the last several years, I've continued to see a couple of black ants, one at a time in the kitchen or somewhere else in the house. And I'm wondering if it's possible that 10-year-old nest is still active and whether the random one-off ants that I'm seeing over and over and over again might be part of a nest from way back when.
So what does the sawdust look like? Is it really fine or?
Yeah, pretty fine. When I removed the eave board, I noticed some of that sawdust, so I sprayed inside the eave. Probably should have called a professional right then, but didn't know any better at the time.
Okay. And is this, so this is kind of by the soffit area, Brent?
Yeah, yep.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it can be a little bit hard to tell in a case like this. My first recommendation would be to do some very thorough detective work. Observe the ants that you do see when you do occasionally see them. If you're just seeing a few ants, it can be very hard to determine sometimes if there's a nest in the house or if these may be workers that are wandering in from outside, because that very feasibly could be a possibility as well, especially this time of the year. So sometimes if you can sit there for 20, 40, maybe even 60 minutes and just watch and follow the ants, that can give you some clues. The carpenter ants, like other ants, they often like to follow edges of baseboards and walls. And so if it were my house and I were seeing that, you know, all the ants seem to be going to this one particular room, one particular area, that would be a red flag to me that maybe there is something going on up there. Versus if you observe them and you conclude that they just seem to be kind of random. Other rooms, no particular pattern. It's quite possible they could be sneaking from outside. You could also go to the outside of your house and also observe, because if you have a nest in somewhere like a soffit overhang, those are often satellite colonies or satellite nests connected to a main nest outdoor somewhere. And so there could be ants occasionally going back and forth between those two, the main nest and the satellite colony. And if you can observe that, that can also give you some clues. Just keep in mind, carpenter ants, sometimes they tend to be more active after dark. So if you haven't tried it, maybe head outdoors after dark with a flashlight and just see if you notice any ant activity. I've done this in my own yard sometimes and you know, followed the ants back to a firewood pile. And if you can find that source and take care of it, that can quiet things down elsewhere.
Brent, thank you for calling. Rob in Port Edwards, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rob.
Fabulous show, gentlemen. Good job. I have two ash trees, and I don't know what flavor. However, I took a gamble. Two years ago, I did the first trimming and injections because these are large, majestic trees, and they had emerald ash borer in it. And then this year, I did the same thing. And it's pricey. They're big trees, big money for the injections. My question is, does this go on now into perpetuity? Do I have to continue every 2 years and keep retreating these trees? I'm more than willing to do it. They're great shade trees. But, you know, is there a point where the tree gets some sort of saturation where it's no longer a buffet for these grubs that get burrowed into the bark? One other quick comment quickly. That gentleman with the ants and the soffits, I had a similar problem, and I took a Sawzall and I cut open my soffit. It was a roof leak that was causing the initial issue. That's how I solved the problem, but it was an ant hotel. So if he can open up with a hole saw or something to get access to where these guys are, I bet you he's going to find a hotel Hilton.
Okay, Rob, thanks for calling. So, ash trees, Rob's spending the bucks, and every 2 years, he's injecting.
Yeah, with ash trees, there's a lot of considerations. And myself, with some colleagues in Extension, we actually have an Extension fact sheet titled along the lines of, is my ash tree worth treating for emerald ash borer? So if you were to Google that, you should be able to find it. And that can help kind of discuss the situation. Ash trees, like other trees, they can provide a lot of value, shade, cooling, things like that. In my own yard, I have one ash tree. Our biggest tree in our backyard is a big, beautiful white ash tree. Really, you know, impacts the character of our yard. If that disappeared, our yard would be very, very different. So there definitely can be a case for treating and protecting those trees. One thing that is interesting, and I have not seen a whole lot of discussion on this topic. We alluded to it a little bit earlier, where I made the comment that when a new pest gets in, it's often kind of like a wildfire. raging, very damaging initially. With emerald ash borer, it's going to go through an area and basically wipe out any susceptible ash tree for the most part, except for treated ones. What happens next at that point in the ballgame? And we don't quite know for sure in terms of what should the next steps be. We know for the trunk injection treatments for emerald ash borer, the product labels say they work for 2 years. However, I've done field experiments with this years ago and chatted with colleagues at other universities as well. We know that the trunk injection treatments that contain the ingredient emamectin benzoate, these are products like Triage and other ones, the label says 2 years. They will protect trees for 3 years, possibly even 4 years. And so there are some cities, for example, that are not treating on a 2-year rotation. They're on a 3-year plan. That allows them to stretch their budget. So that could be a consideration, is lengthening those treatment intervals. That might help us out in time. One other thing we just don't know for sure is once emerald ash borer completely goes through an area, there's probably going to be some presence around because ash trees drop a lot of seeds. There's ash seeds out in the seed bank, so to speak. Those will pop up. And we'll probably have some presence of emerald ash borer in the long run. But what does that mean for treatments? We just don't fully know at this point. But my thought is it'll probably allow us to stretch out treatment intervals. Maybe we don't have to treat every 2 years, maybe 3, 4 years, something like that. And we might shift to the mindset of watching the tree health. EAB won't kill a tree in a single year. It usually takes 3, 4, 5 years. And so if you're not treating and then you see, oh, my canopy looks a little thin, maybe you hop back on the bandwagon and treat at that point and treat for a little while, and then maybe you could pause again. But we're still trying to figure out that aspect of things.
Now, Ross in Crawford County, we'll go to you. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. Thanks, you, Wisconsin Public Radio, and all the great work you guys do. So two questions, one easy, I think, one maybe harder, I think. What would be a good summer book reading, a book that might make the insect world interesting to maybe older teenagers and adults? And then the second question is, I always, when I'm in these summer evenings and you're looking up at the sky, and every once in a while you'll see some bats, and once in a while you'll see nighthawks, I hear the whippoorwills. I'm going to throw the word out, the insect apocalypse. How are we measuring? How are the researchers measuring this quantity of insects that are kind of up in the sky that these animals are eating? And how do you measure that?
Okay, a couple things. First, books for teenagers and adults.
Yeah, gosh, for insect books, it's a little bit hard for me because there's so many good ones out there. If you have interest in a particular group of insects, say fireflies, there's certainly some good ones along those lines. One book that has been out for years and really probably a couple decades at this point by Thomas Eisner is For Love of Insects, and that's a good read. So I'd certainly mention that one. Also, I would say the scientist Bernd Heinrich, he has a couple of books, one called Summer World, one called Winter World, and it's not specific to insects. It talks about wildlife in general, but a lot of his research and expertise is in insect biology, and so those creatures pop up again and again in those books. So any of the books by Bernd Heinrich, like Summer World, Winter World, and so on, those would be some good summer reads as well.
Got about 20 seconds for the
for the insect apocalypse. It's hard to measure, and scientists are still trying to figure out the best way to measure things. And it's interesting with AI and technology, we'll probably get even better ways, but there's no one single best answer in terms of how to most accurately count insects.
And there's a new book about children's book about pollinators we'll be talking about coming up. But PJ, in the meantime, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And you can go to the lab. If you've got a photo or something you want to send to him, UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you got all the information on how to send it. Coming up, we'll be talking about the Nature Place Center in La Crosse and environmental education. I'm Larry Mueller.